The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. On today's pod, easy 3-1 wins for Liverpool and Manchester City while two of the supposed top six slip up at home. Joey Linton's winner for the Magpies makes it a good weekend for strikers. We've pretty much written off after two games. Wesley, Abraham and Haller all scoring and helping their sides to much needed wins. We'll ask the big question of the day, which Barnes hit it better, Ashley or Harvey? Elsewhere, Leeds and Swansea top the championship. Real Madrid slip up in Spain, while some big injuries at PSG could have knock-on effects in the transfer market. We'll answer your questions and work out where Ben Stokes would fit in Liverpool's front three. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, nice to see you.
Hello, happy bank holiday.
Happy bank holiday to you. Happy bank holiday to Tim Stillman.
Hello there.
First pod of the season. Are you excited?
I am. I'm carrying a little bit of pre-season weight, though, still. Just feeling my way back in.
No, that makes sense perfectly. Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning.
Not carrying a lot of weight. In good shape.
Carrying more than I'd like.
Really?
Well, I had like 3 months off after the operation.
True.
So I'm feeling my way. I've done about 2 weeks of training.
There's nothing of you.
You wouldn't say that if you saw me naked.
Oh, really? Okay. The naked pod is a different pod, isn't it? Many questions. We tweeted out for questions for the pod about the football. Pakia says, can you open the pod with a two-minute speech about how brilliant Ben Stokes is? G-Man says, Ben Stokes for Football Writers Player of the Year. I suppose we have to be aware that what percentage of our listeners are abroad? It's something like 30 or 40%. Probably have no interest in cricket whatsoever. So
it's
we don't
a good time to learn then.
Well, possibly. But it was amazing, Jonathan, and you wept.
Yeah, I've never reacted to anything like that. Literally for half an hour afterwards I was in bits. I
just you're sort of welling up. Yeah, yeah. That's a beautiful moment. Oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
The thing was, my hands were shaking.
This is unbelievable.
My hands were shaking.
I didn't think he was capable of this.
I think it was delayed reaction for me because I didn't weep during the cricket. But at the end of Dragon's Den yesterday, a sweet Malaysian man got a deal on some chili paste and everyone was crying and I just burst into tears. It's too much. What was it about it, Jonathan? Can you?
From the northeast, isn't he?
Stokes, do you think that's it?
Yeah.
Do you want to ask someone else a question?
Please, yeah.
I watched an awful lot of that test, but unfortunately didn't get to see much of it yesterday as it unfolded. But myself and a friend were walking into the Spurs ground, just at the sort of ticket checkpoint, and this enormous roar went up. And I thought, I'm sure this kicks off in 15 minutes. We have kind of missed the start.
And well, Newcastle's defence isn't great, so you thought maybe they'd concede 15 minutes before the game starts.
It suddenly occurred to me, gosh, the cricket, England must have won the cricket, and so they had. It was and a real buoyant mood on the concourse and all that. It's amazing.
Right, well, let's go to Spurs-Newcastle then. Spurs nil, Newcastle won. Newcastle won four in a row at White Hart Lane. Wilson, you were pointing out before the pod,
there's two games at Wembley between the first three of those at White Hart Lane and yesterday's game.
Right, because Newcastle's curse of...
Yeah, the dark magic that governs Newcastle's inability to win at Wembley, having cheated Arsenal in 1952, although they subsequently did win two further FA Cups that decade, continues to prevent them winning at Wembley. So Tottenham's curse at home against Newcastle is not as strong as Newcastle's curse at Wembley. Just if Barney wants to go into that in detail.
Now, Barry, you were there. How was the atmosphere?
It was surprisingly flat. I'd venture to say I was sitting in a stand above the Newcastle fans, who were in great voice for the entire game, and I would venture to say if they had not been there, the game would have been played out in almost total silence. It was like watching, I don't know, a touring play in a regional arts centre, occasional murmuring and occasional polite applause. And that was, even before Tottenham scored, before Newcastle scored, it was like that. So I would venture to say that if the White Hart Lane Mandarins have notions of emulating the yellow wall of Borussia Dortmund, they have a long way to go. But it was, I enjoyed the game. Newcastle played very well. Probably a little lucky, but I suppose you were on your luck. They kept their shape brilliantly. From on high, it looked like, I think it was supposed to be a 3-5-2. It was very much a 5-4 and then a huge gap and a 1 was the formation they were playing. Joelinton, Tim has just educated us on how to pronounce his name. It's not Joelinton.
Give us the correct one.
Joelinton.
Joelinton. He looks like a decent player. He took his goal very well, missed another chance. And I think Maurizio Pochettino was very unhappy after the game, and I can see why. Spurs, their only sort of course of action seemed to be to try and get around the Newcastle defence, sending crosses. The crosses weren't up to much. Lucas Moura missed a sitter. Harry Kane missed what I thought was a sitter. Harry Kane possibly should have had a penalty. I haven't actually seen a replay of that yet, so I don't know how aggrieved Tottenham should feel about that one.
Well, let's just cross that off. That is the VAR bit. Lascelles on Kane. He sort of dives head first. Kane does lean his leg into him. Mike Dean didn't give a penalty. This is from Paul Brown, quoting the PGMOL on the VAR call. It was considered not to be a penalty by the on-field referee, as this was a subjective decision. The VAR deemed that there was not enough evidence to overturn the original call, so stuck to the on-field decision. Alan Shearer didn't think it was a penalty. There is a totally unbiased view of this. I sort of think if Lascelles had gone with his feet, it's definitely a penalty. Just because he goes head first, just because it's a weird foul, it's still a foul.
I know what you mean. I think it is probably a penalty. Equally, I can see why it wasn't given, and therefore I can see why VAR is reluctant to overturn, which I think is different from the David Silva one in the Bournemouth Man City game.
Jefferson Lerma on Silva, which is just absolute stonewall.
Yeah, you can see, you know, the Lerma on Silva, you can see completely why the referee doesn't see the offence, because stepping on somebody's foot is probably one of the hardest fouls to see, because it's almost like below the level of the grass when it happens. Mm-hmm. And also the fall that you get from that kind of offence always looks a bit weird. Essentially, the foot has to be sort of dragged out, so the body's going over before the foot flips up. So with that one, I think VAR should have overruled, because it can clearly see the stepping on the foot, which the referee presumably hasn't seen. And if he has seen it, then why is he not given it? This one, while I think it probably should have been a penalty, I understand why Mike Dean didn't give it, and therefore I understand why VAR didn't feel it fit to overrule it.
I mean, I think from what I understand so far, and with VAR, is that at the moment they're backing the referee on pitch a bit too much, and you wonder if the clear and obvious thing will change slowly over time, and they'll say, actually, Mike, that probably was a penalty. Either go and have a look or just trust me, right?
Yeah, I think this is one of those occasions where obviously the kind of line we're getting at the moment is that they're reluctant for the referee to go over and look at the screen because of the delay that creates. And maybe this is one where Mike Dean might have welcomed a second look at it. Again, I agree with Jonathan. I completely understand why VAR it did interfere because it reviewed it, but why they didn't overrule the referee. I mean, for me, I think it's a clear penalty. I mean, ask yourself two questions. Does Lascelles get the ball? No. Does he stop Harry Kane having a shot on goal? Yes. I mean, to me, that's like you say, Max, just because it's a weird foul, a slightly unorthodox one, I think it's an absolute textbook foul.
But having said that, Spurs had to break Newcastle down. They had 80% of the ball. You know, Harry Winks completed 126 passes, 14 short of the entire Newcastle team. Eriksen didn't start again, Barry, and Pochettino is getting increasingly angry about this. He might go before September the 2nd. We saw it with the Villa game with Spurs. They didn't break them down until Eriksen came on. They tried it again, and it didn't work this time.
Yeah, I think he came on after 65 minutes. I did that thing where I just watched him, just out of curiosity, mm-hmm. Partly because I was getting a little bored, and partly because I like him as a player, and I've never done that at a game before. I've heard of colleagues doing it. I think I recall you saying you don't, so I just watched him.
Yeah, I did it with Modric once. It was unreal.
And yeah, he plays took up a position between midfield and strikers, and got a fair bit of the ball and just kept pinging it out to the flanks, really, and for more crosses to come in. But Newcastle made it very difficult for Spurs, who are capable of better, but yeah, just could not break them down. But they had enough chances to get a draw or possibly win the game, but I was kind of pleased for Newcastle, to be honest, because I think Steve Bruce has got a lot of stick. He possibly doesn't, well, he definitely doesn't deserve just for not being Rafa Benitez. And I was happy for him.
It's interesting what you said about the atmosphere, Barry, because I've just got this impression there's a bit of a cloud hanging over Spurs at the moment. Eriksen's kind of half in, half out. Vertonghen's half in, half out. They've tried to sell Danny Rose and not succeeded. Yesterday, Lo Celso's not ready yet, and Ndombele and Sessegnon are injured. And it seems like they've tried to do like a little bit of evolution of the squad, but it's kind of on hold at the moment. They started with no new signings yesterday, and that kind of stale feeling, I think, is still there, which possibly once their new signings are fit and they solve this Eriksen thing, might change.
Well, that's a sort of Daniel Levy issue as well, isn't it? That because he has a tendency to do his business so late in the window, Spurs often seem to start season slowly.
You can't start season slowly if you're trying to win the league, if Spurs are, right? Because one defeat, they're 5 points off City already, right?
Are they trying to win
Liverpool,
the
Liverpool, rather.
Are they?
I don't know.
I mean, I suspect they'd be quite happy with third. True. I mean, really, you know, nobody expects it to be higher than third. It would be a remarkable achievement. It would be a significant surprise if it finished higher than third. They may well. It's not like any of the other teams between third and we expect to be between third and sixth are playing brilliantly or look sensational. So
I don't really understand why the Eriksen thing is an issue. He is a Tottenham player. If you want him to start him, and if he does leave before Sunday, then he's gone. But you know, while he's still there, if you need him,
play
him.
Do you think there's an aspect of trying to rehabilitate? Maybe slightly the wrong word, but try to persuade people Lamella can do that job. I mean, I know that also.
He didn't do it yesterday.
No,
that's for sure.
He's a different player, though, isn't he?
He is a different player, but he is an attacking midfielder who sort of will fit in a similar position in the team.
Sure, but he doesn't give it early. I mean, the joy of Eriksen is he gets it and he gives it early.
Yeah, he's a different player, I agree. Mm. But to try and get them used to playing with Lamella, to bring Lamella back to the level he'd achieved sort of 2 years ago before he got the injuries. And whereas if they play Eriksen, Eriksen is then sold. And Lamella comes in. Lamella looks very obviously second choice.
I mean, I suppose Pochettino started him against City. He probably thought Villa and Newcastle, these are games we can win, give confidence to the side without him, and that may help. We should celebrate.
They've only really played well for maybe half an hour's football this season, that last half hour against Villa.
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't. Yeah, they're not looking anywhere near as good as they did in sort of February, March last year.
We should celebrate just the heroic defending of Newcastle. You know, when you go to a team like, you know, a top six side, you've got to hurl your body in the way. It's a sort of under celebrated part of football, I think.
Yeah, and I saw Newcastle on the opening day against Arsenal, and actually they defended quite well in that game as well. Arsenal may be a bit like Spurs at the moment, haven't really hit their stripes yet, but I mean, there wasn't a lot between Newcastle and Arsenal on the opening day. It really was quite literally Aubameyang got one chance and it was 1-0. They were pretty well organised that day. What they didn't have on that day was anything at all going forward. And it looks like they addressed that because there was far more support for Joe Ellington and Miguel Almiron. They had kind of runners supporting them a little bit. And actually, I think the defensive performance didn't surprise me as much. It was more the fact that particularly in the first half they got greater numbers forward this time.
Right, let's move on. Manchester United 1, Crystal Palace 2. Jonathan, how many designated penalty takers do Manchester United need?
Well, I mean, look, that was, if you're going to miss a penalty, you can't hit a penalty better than miss it. If anything, he's taken a penalty too well.
It was a great strike, wasn't it?
Well, you hear like half the crowd cheer because they think it's gone in, and then only to realise the ball's pinged the inside of the post and spun all the way across goal and gone out for goal kick on the other side. So, look, that penalty does not make Marcus Rashford a bad penalty taker. It's a really, really good penalty in all respects apart from actually going in the net.
This is quite a big detail. How much can we blame Paul Pogba, Barry? Because if he hadn't taken the one against Wolves, Rashford would have scored it and he'd have more confidence.
Oh, I think that the Paul Pogba thing against Wolves, Pogba can take penalties. You know, he has missed a few. I don't think the Paul Pogba thing had any bearing whatsoever on Rashford missing against Crystal Palace.
Well, you
I mean,
that.
I think you're almost certainly right, but I think it suggests weak management that this situation's been allowed to occur.
I would agree with that.
Yeah,
yes.
I just sort of think you have a hierarchy of penalty takers because it's then there's no discussion. You just get on with it and take it. And then if Rashford really kind of, you know, if he's got a dodgy hamstring or something, or really doesn't feel it, so Mateus in the 1990 World Cup final, where, yeah, he was designated penalty taker for West Germany, and, you know, he I can't remember, he'd done something to his ankle or something, and he said, I just don't feel it. Andy, can you take it? And Bremer scores. That's fine, but everybody knew it was Mateus' decision. Whereas as soon as you have a discussion, you're creating a drama around it.
I think this is possibly stepping into the realm of old man yelling at cloud, but this is quite a modern thing where I think players are so kind of wrapped up in their own stats and things like that. You know, you remember the situation at PSG between Neymar and Cavani over who was going to take the penalties there, and I think you see this more and more in kind of modern football at the moment, like players kind of fighting over penalties and, you know, having this kind of 1-2-3 ranking order, and I'll take it if I'm fouled, but if you're fouled, you know, just I agree with you, Barry. It's a bit of a non-issue, but at the same time, I think it's kind of unnecessary.
Without wanting to sound like a proper football man, in Fergie's time, wouldn't have happened.
Well, it didn't happen in Fergie's time.
Oh, there we go. I knew what.
but Fergie then. I can't remember who the players were. It was Giggs and
Mark Robbins.
No. Anyway, Fergie thought Giggs should have taken it, and somebody else took it and missed. And Fergie afterwards said, "It's my fault. I should have made clear Giggs was taking it." So it did happen in Fergie's time, but Fergie admitted that was his mistake for not having been clear beforehand. So whoever was the normal penalty taker was out.
Right, okay.
And which then led to a discussion when they got the penalty.
I think Julian Dix should just take every penalty.
Or Kevin Pressman.
You would take Dix over Graham Alexander?
I saw
Pressman, yeah. The greatest penalty of all time.
Well, if you had to nominate someone to take a penalty to save your life...
It wouldn't be Kevin Pressman now. Jesus Christ. I wouldn't nominate Kevin Pressman to get to the ball.
You mean it would have to be Letizia, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Charles Aranguiz for me. Just look on YouTube at Charles Aranguiz penalties. Smashed into the top corner every time.
Two Copa America finals.
It was Nani missed that penalty against Fulham in 2010.
Nani, okay.
Thank you to producer Jonathan for that. While we're blaming Paul Pogba, can we blame him for the Patrick Van Aanholt goal? He gave the ball away... You know, a good 2 minutes before Van Aanholt scored.
I would certainly give him some of the blame for giving the ball away. I would also blame other defenders for letting Van Aanholt sort of... They parted like the Red Sea as he ventured up the pitch. But seeing as we're blaming Paul Pogba for everything, why not?
It's indicative of United's status these days that when Palace, who haven't won at Old Trafford since 1989, are drawing 1-1 there in injury time... The left back is bombing forward and gets the winner. You know,
you'd expect them to be under siege, yeah.
Well, or just sort of thinking, you know what, 1-1's a good result. You know, just hold the ball up there, get a throw in or something. Not have your left back bombing up to score.
Hmm. Jordan Ayew played well, scored a goal, took it very coolly. Doesn't happen often, that.
Jordan Ayew is the most frustrating player in the history of football.
Wow, that's a big call.
He has so much talent and so little brain. I mean, what frustrated me particularly is him for Ghana. Ghana had a really good team around 2010. Mm-hmm. They'd won the Under-20 World Cup. Those players coming through. They got the final of the Cup of Nations in Angola. And you could have had this front two of Jan. So you have big target man knocking the ball down. Ayew running off him. And that should have worked beautifully. Dele Ayew, Jordan's brother. You know, great player, great leader for Ghana. And you know, everything seemed to be coming together. But Jordan Ayew just ruined it by running offside all the time. I mean, I was about to say that's overstating it. It's not.
Fair enough. Dan James scored a lovely goal. Got booked for diving again, Tim, even though he got kicked. I mean, we need to keep saying it so that reputation sticks now for poor Dan.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I thought he was slightly unfortunate with that, actually. But there is actually something really quite nice and innocent about, you know, he's scored twice at Old Trafford now, and both times it's just looked like it's meant the absolute world to him, which maybe in one respect you could say, again, is, you know, if you're playing for a club like United, you know, maybe scoring at Old Trafford shouldn't feel like you've won a competition or something like that. But there's just been something really kind of sweet about how much it clearly means to him to score. I thought on that occasion, probably quite unlucky. And it's interesting because there was some discussion in the build-up to that where, you know, he was accused of diving the week before. And I think with some justification, actually, against Wolves.
Yeah. Wilfried Zaha will be pleased that someone else got booked for diving. It means the camera's off him. PSG are apparently in for him, Barry, with Cavani and Mbappe both went off injured last night.
Yes.
Can we see Wilf going to Paris?
It would be difficult for him to turn it down, one would imagine.
Can you imagine, though, like, yeah, PSG, the most glamorous club in the world, a club that, you know, Champions League night is like some kind of fashion show or something, where they've got sort of, you know, rock stars in the crowd and actors in the crowd, and their two big forwards have been signed from Stoke and Crystal Palace.
I was watching their game last night, and Maxime Choupo-Moting, he scored two goals, one of them, the first one, an excellent top-drawer finish, and just... How is he banging in goals for PSG after leaving from Stoke? It just makes no sense. But
then Stoke aren't exactly doing brilliantly without him. Maybe that's their problem.
I don't think it's their only problem, isn't it? Let's move on.
You wonder, like, is James McLean there going, I could do a job. I wouldn't get abused for not wearing a poppy.
Actually, speaking of Stoke,
because it's coming up to that time of year again, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, a couple of months.
It was 11 years ago that Ricardo Fuller scored an amazing goal for Stoke where he sort of Bergkamp-esque flicks it over a defender and then puts it in the bottom corner. And I tweeted out that I thought it was actually better.
I agree.
It's
better than the Bergkamp goal because it's more fluid.
That's how I felt.
Yeah.
It didn't go down well amongst some areas of social media. Liverpool 3, Arsenal 1. In the end, it was comfortable, but Arsenal had their chances. Tim, what did you make of this performance?
It's a really weird one to piece together from an Arsenal perspective, because on one hand, I think there were some problems with the way Unai Emery set up. I think the midfield diamond didn't really work. It got pulled out of shape. I think I understand what he was trying to do. I think he was trying to weirdly encourage Liverpool's fullbacks on so that Pepe and Aubameyang could hit on the counter. And actually, they had a fair amount of joy in the first half with that. But on the other hand, they made some mistakes with the goals, which you'd say is probably quite characteristic of Arsenal. But on the other hand, as much as I kind of want to criticise a little bit Unai Emery's approach, I don't really have a better answer. I think Liverpool would just... I still don't think we talk about Liverpool in the same way we talk about Man City, for example. They got 97 points and won the European Cup last year. They're really good. And it's like whack-a-mole when you play Liverpool. You solve one problem and another one pops up. So Arsenal actually did quite a good job on Liverpool's front three for the first 40 minutes or so. But you contain those three and the fullbacks just hit you. So if you concentrate on the fullbacks, then the front three will get you. It's just... So really, I don't, as much as I want to kind of criticise that midfield diamond, I don't have a better suggestion for how you play against Liverpool. I think there's an element to which they're just very good.
Well, were Arsenal not sort of hamstringing themselves by repeatedly trying to play the ball out from the back and then repeatedly losing it?
Yeah.
Liverpool didn't score on the back of that, but it was clearly a huge problem of Arsenal's own making.
Well, that's part of how good Liverpool's press is. Mm. I mean, you know, I think Tim's absolutely right.
But it's no secret that is going to happen,
sure,
so why do it?
What's the alternative? Whack it long to Aubameyang?
Well, whack it long and try and win 50-50 balls, like...
It's Arsenal.
Well, I know that, but, you know, like Newcastle did yesterday against Spurs, it worked to a degree. You know, so
yeah. I mean, I think
it's something. It can't work out worse for you than what they were doing at the moment.
Yeah, well, possibly. But I think Tim's right with the setup. That, I mean, there's something Guardiola said last season, that Liverpool attack inside better than any other team in the world, and you sort of instinctively you think that's just doesn't make any sense because the fullbacks are such a threat. But because the two wingers tuck in, and because they've got those three in midfield who are so energetic. You know, they always do have runners through the middle. So by playing the diamond, you get four men in there, or three plus Ceballos, and you are sort of blocking that up. But the sacrifice then is you say to the fullbacks, okay, you can have the flanks, which is obviously a massive risk when the fullbacks have had 23 assists between them last season. So my sense at the game was the goal was coming. And although Arsenal did have a couple of chances in the first half where you sort of thought, oh, Liverpool have got a bit high again, and... Yeah, it was just eventually they were going to score. So that the corner, I know it's a corner rather than the cross from a fullback, although it was a corner taken by a fullback. I think it was a 20-second cross Liverpool had put in the first 41 minutes, of which 19 had been from fullbacks. And then the second goal is Alexander-Arnold in loads of space, 30 yards from goal, has time to pick his pass, and then David Luiz panics and concedes a penalty. Mm. So eventually both goals did come from that area, but I agree that the sort of you can't you know, the blanket's never big enough.
And I think what it did as well was, I think you saw Arsenal got a bit ragged in the second half because Guendouzi and Willock were kind of on the wide edges of the diamond, and they kept out, and they were essentially being asked to be central midfielders and wingers at the same time, and there's only so long that you can do that, and I think in the second half the effort just became too much.
I mean, I wonder if what you could have done, what Arsenal could have done, was just play without a centre forward and have Pepe wide and Aubameyang maybe not quite as wide on the left, or Aubameyang not quite as wide on the left. And then you can play long because you can just play the ball in behind the fullbacks and get them to chase it because they're both quick. So maybe that's the modification you make to that.
But then you've got to have the ball, right? You've got to have the ball with enough control of it to be able to.
And it's also, there's a point Klopp made afterwards, and I thought it was, you know, a really interesting point you made. You don't often hear managers make interesting points about their opponents, but saying, "Yeah, did they do that in pre-season?" And Klopp was sort of saying that we're so good now, and he didn't say it this arrogantly, but this is sort of the subtext of it. We're so good now that teams come to Anfield and do something they've never done before, and you're asking them in their first ever game doing this to stop us. Mm.
Against the team, as Tim says, who are just good. And David Luiz got some criticism, right? The shirt pull is silly because it's going to...
What was Emery on about, saying that's not enough for a penalty?
Who knows?
The press box is at the other end of the ground. The press box is nearer the cop end. So I must have been, 80, 90 yards from that. I didn't even look at the replay because it was so obviously... Yeah. You saw he took that penalty, right?
Yeah. I mean, you guess VAR would have overturned it, but who knows, right? But Mo Salah is hard to defend against, right?
Ah, come on. I mean, yeah, to be dragged out of position like that... it's not the fact that he's been beaten by a little trick. It's that he's been beaten by a little trick on the touchline 5, 10 yards inside his own half.
He doesn't need to commit himself.
Yeah, and there's a really interesting piece in The Independent last week talking to, I can't remember his name, but the coach who coached Luis at Vitoria, in the club he came through at in Salvador, saying that Luis was a central midfielder and he moved him back into a back three because the coach sort of liked his ability to win duels and he liked his sort of charisma and his aggression, but felt he couldn't cope in the two because he doesn't have a positional sense. And then there's Mark Schwarzer saying that he doesn't defend territorially at all. So he went to try and win the duel, but he completely messed up any kind of defensive organisation. So I think that's a pretty bad... It's not just a pretty bad error, it's a pretty characteristic error.
Yeah, and his kind of explanation afterwards was, well, I was on a yellow card, so I couldn't bring him down. But you're right, you think, well, then don't put yourself into the position where you might have to bring him down. Just defend the space, which is also hard because you're right, Max Salah might have just dribbled past him. But, you know, he's kind of made Salah's mind up for him there quite.
And if he'd stayed in the in the back four and just leaving it, there's still sort of, Salah's still got 30 yards to make up. So a midfielder might get back and slow him down. He might have a slightly dodgy touch. At least you've got time, and or you might even be able to arrange yourself so that, Socrates goes and you can cover him, or you go and Socrates covers
you. Or you can show him down the line or whatever.
Yeah, whereas just taking yourself out of the game and leaving an enormous gap. I mean, Salah still then takes the goal absolutely brilliantly. Hmm. Yeah, who's the player who gets back to him?
I think it might have been Torreira.
Right, but he's holding a player off and then finishes it brilliantly anyway. So it's still sensational from Salah, but. The whole thing was allowed to happen by Luis getting dragged out of position.
Arguably, Mo Salah's penalty was better than Marcus Rashford's. One, because it went in, but we were talking about beautifully struck penalties.
I don't think you're going to see a better one than that. It's perfect.
Absolutely perfect, wasn't it? Liverpool, the only team in the 92 to have a 100% record. Yeah, so only two others managed to win their first three games. Obviously, there's been more games in the Football League, but that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, it's extraordinary. In the Premier League, there's only been three teams that have won two games.
Yeah, so what does that mean?
Means that Manchester City won the title already.
Ollie says, now Van Dijk has been dribbled past, is Nicolas Pepe the new best player in the world? Could this be like the unofficial World Cup? If Harry Winks dribbled past Pepe on Sunday, will he become the best? I think the thing is, Tim, Pepe looks exciting, right? Lots of people will say raw, but he's got something.
Yeah, hugely. And Arsenal have lost a succession of guys who can actually dribble, like Oxlade-Chamberlain, Sanchez, Cazorla, even Wilshere, or the kind of rough approximation of the ghost of Jack Wilshere, as it were. But they really needed someone who could do that. But even so, Pepe looks, his ball control is, it reminds me a little bit of Kanu, actually, in that you think he's so deceptive. You think you can just whip the ball off of his toe and he just somehow wraps his foot around it and nicks it away from you. And he's got such like a languid style, but for Arsenal, he was really the kind of the real positive, I think. And against teams who aren't as good as Liverpool, which is namely about 17 other teams in the Premier League, I think he'll do some real damage.
He doesn't have as big a feet as Kanu. Didn't Kanu have like size 15 or something?
Kanu's, no.
Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Carrow Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We've got some live shows on the 10th of September in Manchester. Barry, you're coming.
Good.
Wilson, you're coming.
Yep.
And Lars Sivertsen joins us as well. Then we cross the Pennines. It takes us 10 days. We march from Manchester to Leeds. Me, you again, Wilson. You again, Barry. Faye Carruthers joins us for our first live show in Leeds. Have you done one in Leeds before?
No.
No?
First Lizard one in Leeds before.
Oh, it doesn't count. First ever live show in Leeds. Come along, please.
Britain's most popular football quarterly.
How many others are there?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Probably none.
20th of September, that one in Leeds. All the details, we'll tweet them all out. So buy your tickets, come along. Norwich City 2, Chelsea 3. Wow, this was a lot of fun, Jonathan, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of following it on a hideous train journey across the Pennines, actually, appropriately. A combination of York races, some music festival in Liverpool, and I believe one in Leeds as well, plus a hen do, plus a really hot day, plus the next train being cancelled. And it was pretty horrific.
Well, was it a train where the windows, you can open them or not?
No.
Oh, that is a disaster.
No, you had me at Hindu, to be honest.
It was just this distended people tube of hell.
I would have just given up, aborted my wherever.
Pull the cord when you walked out.
A woman wearing a veil and an L plate and some cackling harpies have just got on. I am off. I'm out.
But anyway, what I subsequently saw of it suggested to me that Chelsea were worryingly open again for all they had more firepower than Norwich.
Their defence needs a lot of work. I would imagine Frank Lampard is absolutely delighted to get the win. I mean, Jake Humphrey did an interview with him on BT Sport, which had been recorded previous in the week, and when they'd shown it, Humphrey said, you know, I asked him, and he just said, I just want a win, I really need a win, and so he got it. But that is very much a work in progress, that Chelsea side, and Norwich exposed them a lot, scored two goals, could have scored more, and
I mean, they missed Kante, is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I actually thought Norwich would win that game, and then when it emerged that on Friday evening that Kante may not be fit and subsequently wasn't in the squad, definitely go for Norwich now, but they weren't good enough ultimately.
Tammy Abraham, two excellent finishes there, Tim. And you know, that's really important for him, isn't it?
Yeah, and you have to be, you know, I was saying about Daniel James's celebration, quite sweet, but same with Tammy Abraham, particularly with that first goal, and his interview afterwards was great, actually, as well, because he just said, I didn't know what to do, because I was so kind of beside myself with joy, so he kind of ran over to Frank Lampard, but yeah, huge for him, and, you know, this kind of, like, I remember, obviously, Olivier Giroud playing for Arsenal, was such a weird striker, so divisive, because sometimes you're absolutely convinced that he must play, but then sometimes he plays and you think, no, we need someone who can do more than this. And
Does he get better when he's not playing?
I think so. And I think actually he's probably better coming off the bench anyway. But yeah, huge for Tammy Abraham. I'll preface this by saying I only saw the highlights, but I just don't trust teams that win 3-2 or 4-3 at the top end of the table. I think largely because I support one. But because that just implies this kind of element of chaos to the way that they play, that they're not really in control. And, you know, yeah, I obviously Chelsea would be delighted with the points, but some big questions, I think, still.
Tammy Abraham was rewarded for his first two goals for Chelsea by being left behind.
Oh, really?
At Carrow Road, because he was unable to deliver a sample for his drug test, so they got so tired of waiting for him, they just left him there.
Is he still there?
I don't know.
there's something funny about... Obviously, football is not like a normal job, but it's a very strange job where if you do something good, you embrace your boss with such emotion. It's not like...
No one likes a crawler, Tammy.
I wonder if it'll change. You know, it's good for Lampard. You know, it shows him in a good light that the players like him. It's all very... So I wonder if you do a really good pod, I could run into the editor of the Guardian's office and just embrace them, having never met them. It'd be a strange thing to do. Mason Mount, lovely... Lovely goal from him as well. On form, you'd put him in the England squad, would you?
In the squad? Yeah, maybe.
It's tricky. I mean, Grealish is playing well as well.
There's a lot of players in that sort of position of attacking midfield. I mean, Maddison as well, I think.
True.
Has now got a good shout.
Over say, Lingard and Ali, who Ali's injured, isn't he?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, he's definitely in the conversation. But, I mean, Lingard is not in form, but he is a man in possession. And do you really want to break that up?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And Norwich as well. Look, candidates for the most fun team early on, aren't they?
Yeah. Timu Puku scored again, making idiots.
Of you?
Who suggested he may not be able to hack it in the Premier League look very foolish indeed. Norwich, good going forward. Slightly chaotic at the back. Grant Hanley seems to get a lot of stick from... I don't know if it's from Norwich fans, but just he seems to have this reputation as being not very good. I thought he was all right on Saturday. But yeah, him and Ben Godfrey seem to be doing a lot of lunging in, throwing themselves in front of shots. And it's slightly chaotic at the back there for Norwich. I think they'll be okay on the evidence of what I've seen so far. But the season is obviously very young yet.
Back to your whack-a-mole analogy, Tim. Bournemouth 1, Manchester City 3. I mean, City's first two goals, passing and moving at such pace. Aguero's first and then Sterling's. How do you defend against it?
Yeah, that's exactly the thing, isn't it? Is that Liverpool and City are so similar in that you know exactly what they're going to do. You know exactly how they're going to play, with the cutbacks and things like that. But everyone just seems completely powerless to stop it. And I think Eddie Howe kind of said, I mean, Bournemouth had their chances in this game and you know, arguably could have made this a much closer game. But I don't know, maybe a bit like Liverpool-Arsenal. Arsenal had chances, but even if they'd gone 1-0 up, you just don't have the sense that they'd have been able to win the game, that City would have found another gear and found another goal from somewhere.
The XG on that game was 3-point-something for City and 2 for Bournemouth.
So. Well, Adam Smith had a great chance, which hit Edison's head. Callum Wilson's cleaned through. And Edison actually probably could have gone.
Well, I think
for that
Edison
challenge.
And Kyle Walker both should have gone.
Remind me of the Walker.
Well, it's two yellows. He didn't get booked for the first one.
I thought the first one was...
Worse than the second.
Probably. No, I thought the first one was a yellow. I thought the second one was a red.
Well, right, but he got nothing in any yellow. Yeah.
He ended up with one yellow.
Well,
he definitely
whether
should
he'd
have
gone in for the second one like that, if he'd already been a yellow, I don't know. But yeah, the Edison one, goalkeepers get away with that.
And just being in a different kit, do you think?
I think, yeah, and there's two slightly separate things. So the obvious thing is, it's a high late challenge, which I think from an outfielder, everybody would be immediately up in arms, that's a red card. Because it's just so high. So there's that. But then there's a second thing where I almost think the offence is two yellows in one, in that it's a cynical foul. If Callum Wilson gets by him, he can then cross into a box, there's an open net, and there's players coming in. So it's a denial of a chance of a goal-scoring opportunity. So that's the yellow for that cynicism. But it's also, even if you don't think it's a red for the challenge, it's at least a yellow for the challenge. So you then think, well, it's two yellows on the same offence. Is that not then a red?
I mean, you wonder, in the same thing that we talked about, Jefferson Lerman's foul on David Silva, that VAR will slowly but surely come to a slightly more middle ground with these decisions as well.
But there seems to be a general trend with referees, and has been for several years, that goalkeepers get away with it. Yeah. I mean, I remember there was one in the World Cup in 2014 and that Brazil-Colombia or Brazil-Chile game when whoever Brazil keeper was committed
Julius
this.
Cesar.
Yeah. I mean, committed a terrible studs-up challenge and only got a yellow card for it. And you sort of think, anybody else on the pitch, it's a red card offence. And or actually, even in the final, when Neuer clatters through Higuain, why is that not a red card? A head-high challenge.
And also, in 82, arguably, Schumacher did take out Battiston.
Well, you think
that?
I think so. 50-50,
right, okay, right. I think that, yeah, while it obviously should be a red card, is not as bad a challenge as Neuer's. It's cowardly,
yeah,
because he's realised he's not going to get the ball and he's turned his back. But if you're trying to smack somebody in the head, you don't go in with your hip. You go in with your foot. And Neuer goes, you know, hits Higuain, you know, not with his hip.
You also had that, was it Mane got sent off at City a few years ago for like a studs high challenge on the goalkeeper? Was it Claudio Bravo or Edison? I can't remember who the goalkeeper was, but he was sent off and he was clearly going for the ball, but where it was like studs high, the foul on the goalkeeper.
It was Edison.
Yeah, yeah.
Harry Wilson's free kick was glorious, wasn't it? So much dip, perfectly placed. Nice place for him to be to get used to playing for Liverpool, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good.
It's great that Liverpool have got another great forward. They really need one of those.
Sheffield United 1, Leicester City 2. Harvey Barnes, what a strike that was, Barry.
Yes, and it's prompted a WhatsApp chat among us.
Yes, I was just
pondering, you know, great half volleys of our time, which then sort of went on to become what exactly is a half volley, a philosophical discussion about what constitutes a proper half volley.
It's got to be just as the ball bounces.
Right, right? The ball's definitely got to be on the up after the bounce.
Yes, I agree.
So Ashley Barnes, the ball is dropping again after the bounce. That's definitely not a half volley.
Not a half volley. Still a great strike.
Harvey Barnes, yeah, a great strike. I'm not denying that. It's just the categorisation of that. He's hit a bouncing ball. It's not a half volley.
Yeah.
Harvey Barnes, definitely a half volley because the ball's just bounced and he's hitting it on the way up again.
I'd say, can we think of any absolute classic half volleys?
I went on YouTube and watched an 11-minute. I like to do research, as you know.
I agree. I bet it was a fun 11 minutes.
But it wasn't. I got really angry because there's so many supposed half volleys on there.
Was it interrupted halfway through by a Hindu?
Well, no, it wasn't, but it was spoiled by the ludicrous soundtrack they'd given it. Sebastian Kehl for Borussia Dortmund against Hoffenheim, I think, was the best on there. Jack Wilsh against West Brom. But it also had on Yeboah's goal against Wimbledon. Well, the ball's bobbling in front of him. That's not a half-volley.
It's not a half-volley. I think a half-volley has to come from another player, I think. Or,
yeah, you can't set it up for yourself.
Yeah, you can't take the touch
before. And also,
before.
I think the ball probably has to be coming towards you. The ball can't be moving the same direction that you are, because then you're just running onto a moving ball.
Yeah, I think I'd
so. It's either got to be coming laterally or coming towards you. Harvey Barnes, definitely half volley and definitely a great strike.
Did anyone enjoy Jamie Vardy's celebration? He was at Sheffield Wednesday till he was released at 16. Sheffield United fans giving him some stick, and he did the old Hulk Hogan looking fury. No one looks angrier when they score, do they?
That's the thing. I didn't make that connection at all at first, because that's how Jamie Vardy always celebrates. I didn't understand that there was anything like specially reserved for Sheffield United fans. He's got I quite enjoy it, actually. He's got a real chippiness when he scores, and he clearly enjoys it. So,
lovely header from Ollie McBurney as well, who's grown a big ginger beard and is looking as Scottish as you possibly can at the moment. Looks like groundsman Willie.
Did I hear he was at Swansea's game against
Birmingham yesterday, was he?
No. QPR, did they play midweek?
They played QPR midweek. Our friend of the show, Ellis, James, was at the game at Loftus Road, and Ollie McBurney was in the away end leading the songs and the singing and the chanting with the Swansea fans. I think someone took a picture of him, which went viral, and I think Ellis is in the background.
Looking with complete awe.
Yeah. Ellis is just generally very happy at the moment. I mean, they do play Cambridge United on Wednesday in the Carabao, so what a way to come crashing down to earth there. It was a great save from Kasper Schmeichel at the end to keep it 2-1. And Chris Wilder's, his honesty is great, I think. And, you know, at the end he was just like, oh, we didn't deserve anything. You know, yes, the crowd gave them an ovation for putting a shift in. He's like, well, that's the least our players can do. I quite like that. He's a good addition in the management.
Well, I mean, his record is excellent. He's a very good manager.
He is. Watford 1, West Ham 3. Sebastian Haller with 2. Mark Noble's penalty give West Ham their first win of the season. They're bottom of that group of 10 teams on 4 points each. Barry, do we think Watford are in trouble?
Yeah. I think Javier Gracia is in trouble. They are a sacking club and they had an excellent season last season, but their record so far this season obviously is awful, and I think there's 7 consecutive defeats across the 2 seasons, so I would say definitely they're in trouble. Now admittedly what's his name, Will Hughes missed a sitter against West Ham, but yeah, 3 defeats straight off the bat. It's not good.
It is not good.
I wonder if Watford, they just seem to have this thing where perhaps managers really do just have a shelf life of 12 months there, because Gracia was doing a really good job for almost exactly 12 months, and now it just seems to have, maybe it's just like the pump, you know, I was going to use the Cinderella analogy there, but it went out of my head. But yeah, maybe like they do just have a very definite shelf life of 12 months and that's it. And maybe what the lesson here for Watford is that they should have sacked Javi Gracia on exactly 12 months.
Before he turned into a pumpkin.
Yes.
maybe 5 minutes before kickoff in the FA Cup final.
Sebastian Haller, how good is he, Wilson?
Well, he is good. And I thought he was good in the Bundesliga. Yeah, I thought he was a good signing. You know, West Ham have got a habit of turning good forwards into poor forwards and also signing poor forwards. Before the season started, I sort of thought this actually might be a decent season for West Ham because they've got a lot of creative players and now they've got the centre forward to make the most of it. And, getting off the mark is clearly a useful thing, and a load of strikers did it this weekend.
Brighton 0, Southampton 2. Vlad Dumitrescu asks, can you find a justification for Andone's absurd red card? I'm Romanian. I'm worried this kind of stupidity runs in the genes.
Well, did you see Match of the Day 2 last night?
I did, but I didn't watch that bit.
Something they picked out was before the game, was it Bernardo?
Yeah, did he spit some chewing gum?
There's like 4 Brighton players walking down some steps. Bernardo spat out his chewing gum and tried to volley it. But unfortunately, Andone paused and bent over just as he did it. So he ended up kicking him on the back of the leg. And he was absolutely furious. And so perhaps that anger then carried over into the game and he committed a genuinely horrendous challenge. I mean, I think
it sort of didn't look malicious.
Well, yeah, I think not malicious. I don't think he kind of thought, right, I'll break this guy's leg. But I think he thought, right, I'll put myself between me and the ball, but did it in such a reckless way that it was incredibly dangerous and an obvious red card.
Brighton did take the lead. Lewis Dunk's goal was ruled out for offside, which looked completely correct, didn't it? Even Dan Byrne, who is, you know, the 8-foot Brighton defender, didn't really celebrate because he knew he was just standing on the goalkeeper. First goal for Moussa Djenepo. He was born on the 15th of June 1998. On that day, England beat Tunisia 2-0 in the World Cup in France. It was an evening game, so we can presume that was the first game that he ever took in. And he saw Scholes curled finish, which was not massively unlike his.
Was he born in France? I know he's Malian, but was he born in France?
I haven't...
Because obviously that game took place in France.
True. So he could have gone.
Maybe he was born in the stadium. I mean, did he find out that he wasn't? Because that appears to be the way you're judging these things.
Aston Villa 2, Everton 0. Jack Grealish, I thought, was great again. Really quick thinking for the Wesley goal. Important for Wesley to get off the mark as well. Everton did have their chances, though, Tim, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And you know, Everton are just such a weird team because there was this kind of, you know, stats circulating that they hadn't conceded a goal yet after all of their defensive problems last season. And you start to think, maybe they're turning a bit of a corner here. And then they go to Aston Villa, who've not had a very good start, and then somehow get turned over and concede 2 goals. But yeah, I think if you ran that game kind of through a simulator again another kind of 10 times, I think Everton would get a result more often than not.
I think we get a bit misty-eyed about, you know, any stadium that's back in the Premier League and go, isn't it great to have that? But the Holt End does look...
Oh, Villa Park's a great
ground. Like a great... I agree.
It's just so solid. You know, you go to a lot of modern stadiums and a bit sort of, you know, tin and concrete. The Holt End's built of brick. You know, it's like a proper old stadium. I love going to Villa Park.
I've never been to Villa Park.
Well, it's good. You should go.
Oh, right.
There's a big statue of, what's his name? William McGregor at one end. One of the great early pioneers of the game.
What did he do?
Well, the famous story about him is his wife was always very worried when he went out to play, and some club official she was talking to him and she said, "I'm always worried that he's going to come home with a broken leg." And the club official goes, "Madam, don't worry, it won't be his."
I've seen that Everton fancy new midfielder Jean-Philippe Mbaman is going to be out for 3 months, I read this morning, with some manner of knack.
Okay. Right, last game, Wolves 1, Burnley 1. 3 draws for Wolves, who haven't been ahead in the league game this season. We mentioned that strike from Ashley Barnes. I mean, it's a brilliant hit. 4 for him in his first 3. It's the first time he's got 4 Premier League goals in a season before January. He is underrated. I mean, is he underrated? I can't say it.
It was the first thing Peter Crouch said on Match of the Day 2 last night. Oh, he's so underrated.
No, I know I said last pod, he can't be underrated because we keep saying he's underrated. But that's
and
finished.
Then in the very next Football Writers pod, Mike Calvin opened by going, Ashley Barnes is so underrated.
Well, I tell you who is underrating him is the Austrian selectors. I mean, him and Arnautovic up front seems like a great front two to me.
I mean, I think as an attacking side, Burnley are quite underrated. They've kind of really, I think they've moved on a bit from when they were first promoted. And that kind of front two of Barnes and Wood, really, really decent front two with McNeil supporting them. And again, I saw them against Arsenal last week and they caused Arsenal a lot of problems going forward.
And they had a lot of chances to make it two, although their last shot came on 58 minutes. Maybe Sean Dyche thought he'd shut up shop. Was it a penalty? It was softer than Kane's or Silva's.
Yeah, but Jimenez does get kicked on the back of the ankle. I know he sort of put his foot there to be kicked, but I mean, if it hadn't been given, VAR would not have overturned it. But I think once it's been given, it probably stays.
It's a lot of umpires' calls, basically. That's what VAR is.
At the moment, yeah.
Fine. In the Football League, in the Championship, 3-0 wins for Leeds and Swansea. Keep them joint level at the top. They face each other next weekend. 10 days since Jan Siewert was sacked, Huddersfield are still without a replacement or a win. They lost 2-0 to Reading. State joint bottom with Stoke, who left Jack Butland on the bench for that game. He's wanted by some foreign teams. They've put a massive price tag on him, Stoke, and he let in some poor goals in midweek. Bristol City won 3-1 at Hull, making it 3 wins on the bounce. Wigan scored their first goal since the first game of the season, although they lost 3-1 at QPR. In League One, the big news is off the pitch. Steve Dale's agreed to sell Bury FC to the sport analytics company CNN Sporting Risk, co-founded by Alistair Campbell's son Rory. They've had their deadline extended to 5 p.m. on Tuesday to complete that deal and avoid being expelled from the league. Fans are being asked to come to Gig Lane with buckets and cleaning materials to get the stadium ready to host games again after a summer which has seen many of the staff leave. There's a 5-way tie at the top with Ipswich, Blackpool, Wickham, Sunderland and Coventry on 11 points each. Excited, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, mates of mine who were there on Saturday said it was the best performance under Jack Ross. Characterised obviously by a stupid, sloppy defensive error to concede the goal to make it 1-1, because somebody of every Sunday game this season has to be 1-1. But Chris Maguire hat-trick, and things are finally looking up.
Ipswich are top on goal difference. They beat a young Bolton side 5-0 as their own struggles go on. Bolton also have a 5 p.m. deadline on Tuesday to prove that they're fit to continue the season. Wickham came back from 2-0 and 3-1 down to beat Southend 4-3 in a ding-dong classic. Southend's 5th defeat in 5. Spare a thought for Matty Taylor on loan at Oxford United, returning to Bristol Rovers for the first time since he crossed the city to join Bristol City in deadline day January 2017. The Oxford coach arrived with a police escort. He was booked after 15 minutes, went off injured just past the half hour, and Rovers won 3-1. Portsmouth game against Rotherham was called off due to policing conflicts with a music festival in the city. That wasn't one of the ones that was affecting your train journey, Wilson.
It probably
people
was
like music.
Yeah, also King's Cross was closed as well. So, and also there's the World Transplant Games in Newcastle, Gateshead and Sunderland. So there's loads of athletes from that on the train.
Okay, that's an athletics event. That's not a sort of live transplant event.
Well, yeah. setting the world record for a heart transplant. 17 and a half minutes. I mean, he did die 3 minutes later, but
Is that like the three lights have to go on with a weightlifter? You have to keep them alive for 3 minutes and then it's fine, whatever happens.
It's like an Olympics for people who've had an organ transplanted.
Oh, right. Oh, I didn't
so know. There was an Australian swimmer sitting in front of me who hadn't won a medal, an Australian woman with him who had won medals but didn't work out what sport in, and then a woman sitting across the aisle who'd won a silver in individual archery and a bronze in the team archery.
Oh, right.
And she was very much Mancunian.
In League Two, Exeter are top. Late winner from Nicky Law, giving them a 3-2 win at Morecambe, followed by Plymouth and Forest Green Rovers, keeping the South West at the top of the league. Below them, Macclesfield and Newport both won 1-0 against Scunthorpe and Crewe, respectively. Salford drew their third game in a row. They're down to 15th, two places below fellow promoted team Leighton Orient, who lost 3-2 to Crawley, having twice been ahead. Cambridge lost 2-1 at home to Oldham Athletic in a game refereed by a man called Scott Oldham. That can't be acceptable. I'm furious about it. All sorts of funny business. Fitbar Corner, Barry.
Short and sweet. It was not a particularly exciting weekend in Scotland. Celtic won 3-1 against a Hearts team that didn't put up much resistance. Interestingly, Fraser Foster started in goal for Celtic after moving there on loan from Southampton, where he couldn't get arrested, never mind a game. Don't know if he's going to be first choice keeper or they're just keeping Craig Gordon fresh for uninjured and healthy for the return leg of their game against the Swedish side AIK in the Europa League on Thursday. They're 2-0 up in that one. Rangers made it 3 from 3 with a work-like win over St Mirren. Borna Barisic, he scored his first goal for the club. And they drew their Europa League qualifier first leg with Legia Warsaw 0-0 away from home. So that one's very much in the balance. And they reckon 3,000 seats or so at Ibrox will be empty for the second leg because they've been punished for their fans singing about the Billy Boys or whatnot at a previous Europa League game in an earlier qualifier. And Celtic go to Ibrox next weekend for the first meeting of the two teams in the league. And at the bottom of the league, Kilmarnock Hearts are, I suppose, surprisingly joint bottom of the table with 1 point each after 3 games.
Thank you so much, Barry. And that'll do for part two. We'll begin part three with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, excellent. So how was the weekend?
Well, it was a fairly dull weekend in which there were, I haven't got the figures in front of me, but I think I'm right in saying the results were 1-0, 2-1, 0-0, 1-1, 0-0, 1-1, 1-0, 0-1, 1-0. And then we got the Barcelona game at the end with a 5-2, which finally kind of made it, managed to make it a little bit more exciting.
A less binary weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I was looking through it and worked out all of those goals. Obviously, every team has either got 0 or 1, except for Levante, it was, against Villarreal. They scored 2, both of those penalties in the space of 2 minutes. From open play, there'd been 7 goals in a Barcelona game and 9 goals in all the other games put together. And to make things worse, like, you're always kind of gambling a little bit. At least I'm always gambling a little bit over the course of the weekend and which games to go to and so on. And because the Getafe Athletic Bilbao game and the Real Madrid Valladolid game were back to back, I had to make a decision which involved leaving one early and getting to the other late to be able to get to both of them. So across those two games there were 4 goals and I saw none of them. It didn't go particularly well.
On that Madrid game, you know, they slipped up, 1-1 draw. What happened?
Well, I think in a way what happened is it felt like the old Madrid. I mean, obviously in kind of literal terms it was the old Madrid. You look at the starting 11. And I think I'm right in saying that there wasn't a player in that team that wasn't there already in 2015. So they spent €300 million on signings this summer and no change in team. Now, in fairness, of course, Eden Hazard is injured and the other players we knew were squad players that would improve the squad rather than necessarily go straight into the starting 11. So, I mean, up to a point, it's logical. But, of course, the big kind of the two names that really screamed at you on the team sheet were James Rodriguez and Gareth Bale, two players that Zidane has really, really tried to get rid of and really pushed the club to try and get rid of, not just to generate money for other signings, but also because simply he didn't want them. But of course, Gareth had played in week one and provided the assist for a pretty good performance from Real Madrid away in Vigo, this time round up against Valladolid team. And actually, it did feel like it was going to be one of those two that scored. In the first half, they seemed to be taking it in turns to have shots. I think there was one Benzema shot and one Casemiro shot, and then the other kind of eight or nine shots, they're all Bale or James. Bale probably should have taken one, maybe two of his chances, but there weren't a huge amount of clear chances. And it felt a little bit like the Real Madrid team that we saw last year, which was a lot of the ball, a lot of possession, quite a lot of shots, but not a huge amount of really clear-cut chances. They did eventually find a way through. Benzema scored, I think, with about 20 minutes to go, 15, 20 minutes to go. Anyway, I know it was late enough that I'd gone by then. And sort of Real Madrid won the lovely thing like that. They're done. They're going to win this quite comfortably. But finally, bit by bit, it started to pressure them in those last kind of 15, 20 minutes. And they got an equaliser with 2 minutes to go. And it felt, in that sense, it felt very much like what we saw last year. You know, a Madrid team that probably should win games, but didn't quite do enough to say, yeah, they'll definitely win this, and then got caught out. And Zidane used this phrase at the end of the game, which everyone's got very excited about, which I think has been overplayed a little bit, but basically Madrid lose the ball towards the end, and he used a phrase which essentially says, you know, we should just hoof the bloody thing. And people have kind of grasped onto this quite excitedly.
Zinedine,
it was slightly sweary, the way he said it.
Yeah, Zinedine, John Beck, Zidane, that's what we want. Just hit it down the channel. You mentioned that 5-2 win for Barcelona. Betis scored first, though. Were there nerves there?
Yeah, there were. Although the truth is, actually, I thought Barcelona had started reasonably well. There were some nerves, and obviously when they'd gone 1-0 down, the fact that they've got no Dembélé, no Suarez, no Leo Messi, that they were beaten last weekend against Athletic Bilbao up at San Mamés, there was, there's a kind of sense, wow, this is really going to fall apart now. But as I say, the start had actually been okay despite that goal. And Griezmann led them back. He scored the equaliser. He then scored the goal to make it 2-1 with that celebration you've probably seen by now where he throws confetti over himself. And I think it was really, really important for Griezmann emotionally to kind of lead the team, to prove that he can do it. He knows, you know, he arrived at the club a year too late. He knows that the way that it happened last year annoyed a lot of people. He knows that some of his teammates were not that keen on coming. And he knows in particular that Luis Suarez and Leo Messi are very keen on the idea of Neymar coming, which can't help but be a threat to him up to a point. And so I think he knows that he was under this kind of pressure. And so he scores this goal, and a brilliant goal, the second one. And he says, well, I watch Messi do this in training every day, so I thought I'd copy it. So he copied Messi and LeBron James, because that was, of course, the inspiration for the confetti celebration.
Where does the confetti, is it hidden in his sock, or does he get it off a mate?
No, so he goes across to the guy who runs Barcelona's social media accounts, who's standing at the side of the pitch, has a little metallic container of red and blue stars. Very tiny red and blue stars. He pours them into Griezmann's hands, and Griezmann throws them up. And of course, Griezmann's standing there in front of the north end of the ground, where obviously there are fans, but also photographers. So you know, as soon as he does this, you know this is tomorrow's photograph. You know, like the football team that wins the title, and these days they always put confetti blowing up around them. Effectively, Griezmann had done that. But as I say, it was inspired by LeBron James, who has this pre-match, or had this pre-match ritual of covering his hands in chalk and then throwing, like, if you like, the excess chalk up in the air, like a kind of a puff of smoke, like a magician. Oh, okay. So Griezmann kind of took it from there.
I've been at weddings where the vicar is, or the priest has specifically asked guests not to throw confetti because it's really hard to clean up afterwards, depending on the surface outside the church door. So
yeah, it's a pain in the ass, yeah.
Yeah, Griezmann should be more considerate for the groundsman, in my opinion.
A friend of mine at a wedding threw a whole... it was quite hot, and the confetti, she didn't realise, had sort of stuck into one ball. And when she threw it, it went right down the cleavage of the bride and stained the whole of the wedding dress from the inside. It was brilliant. Anyway, Sevilla and Atletico, only two teams with 100% records. I mean, we want a four-way title race, Sid. Have we seen enough to hope that that might happen?
Well, I think we all thought, even before the season started, that we would get a three-way one, that Atletico Madrid would be very strong this year, that we weren't entirely convinced about the improvements made at Real Madrid. We felt like Barcelona should be better with Griezmann arriving and De Jong arriving, but you know, some of those underlying problems were there. So I think we thought three-way anyway. I don't think anyone seriously thinks Sevilla are going to be in there all the way through the season, but it's a reasonably good start for them. Bear in mind, Lopetegui, their manager, who of course was the guy that was Spain and Real Madrid manager, also won his first three games of Real Madrid last year. So, you know, there's no guarantee of anything. From Atletico Madrid's point of view, or at least from our point of view, Atletico Madrid was significant as well, not just because João Félix played very well, because it was another 1-0 win, also because Kieran Trippier played very well again. Gareth Southgate was at the game at Leganés. And, you know, of all the great Spanish cities, you start with Leganés. It's pretty bold from Southgate, that. And he watched a very good Trippier performance again. The Atletico Madrid fans really like him.
Oh, that's great. And Martin Odegaard scored his first La Liga goal.
Well, this kind of fits in as well with the Barcelona game. The thing I didn't point out was that Barcelona sent on this kid called Ansu late on in the second half, about 12, 15 minutes ago. And he's the youngest player to make a debut for them since 1941, the second youngest player ever. He's 16 years, 9 months and 25 days, I think it was. And of course, the reason why I say this about Odegaard is because, of course, Odegaard became the youngest player to play for Real Madrid and yet disappeared. And we all sort of thought, oh, well, that was a waste of time. But correct me if I'm wrong, I think he's still only 20 and he's going to get continuity this year playing for Real Sociedad. And it's actually quite exciting because I think we might find out that he's genuinely quite good.
20, born the 17th of December, 1998.
Thank you very much.
Hey, no worries. Sid, no, thank you. And we'll speak to you soon.
Good stuff. Take care. Cheers.
Cheers, Sid. Sid Lowe out in Spain to Germany now. And Archie Rinter on the Bundesliga with goals galore as 7 teams score 3.
In the Bundesliga this week, Jadon Sancho scored and assisted again as Borussia Dortmund came from behind to win again, this time 3-1 away at Cologne on Friday night. Sancho, much like the rest of his teammates in the first half, didn't have a great game, but it turned on two substitutions made by Dortmund coach Lucien Favre. He brought on Julian Brandt in midfield and Ashraf Hakimi at left back. Sancho scored the equaliser, Hakimi got the second, and then in injury time, Sancho laid up Paco Alcácer to get Dortmund's third. They are top of the league with 2 out of 2. Bayern Munich on Saturday night won 3-0 away at Schalke, a Robert Lewandowski hat-trick, meaning that they recover a little bit after that 2-2 draw they had against Hertha last weekend. They were pretty comfortable in this as well. Felipe Coutinho came on to make his debut, his first appearance after signing on loan from Barcelona, of course. Schalke unhappy about some VAR decisions that they didn't get regarding penalties when they were 2-0 down, but going forward on the whole, they were a little bit harmless. Everton loanee Jonjo Kenny started at right back for Schalke, did okay, didn't have a great game for me, gave away the penalty for Bayern's first, clumsily tackling Kingsley Coman. But, as I found on Twitter, his Scouse accent is going down really well with the locals in Gelsenkirchen. Elsewhere, Germany international Timo Werner signed a new contract at RB Leipzig until 2023. His previous deal was running out next summer, and that's a blow to Bayern, who it looked like were going to try and lock him up on a free transfer next summer. He celebrated that new contract with a goal against Eintracht Frankfurt on Sunday, RB Leipzig winning 2-1 in that game. Julian Nagelsmann, the new coach there, of course, moved across from Hoffenheim, 2 out of 2 as well. The other results, just to run down them, Paderborn 1, Freiburg 3. Freiburg also 2 out of 2, that's a bit of a surprise. Wolfsburg as well, another one of these teams who have a 100% record so far, winning 3-0 away at Hertha. Then you have Leverkusen, they won a Rhein derby away at Fortuna Dusseldorf by 3-1. Lewis Baker, Chelsea loanee, not impressing in this one. Did well last week against Werder Bremen, but scoring an own goal this time around. Then, just to round up the other results, Mainz 1, Gladbach 3, Augsburg 1, Union Berlin 1, and Hoffenheim 3, Werder Bremen 2.
Thank you, Archie. In France, you mentioned PSG, Baz, bouncing back from last week's defeat, beating Toulouse 4-0, and 2 for Choupo-Moting. He came on for Edison Cavani. He's got a groin problem. Kylian Mbappe also going off injured with a thigh problem, hence that interest in Wilfried Zaha. Also questions, I guess, any potential move away for Neymar. Monaco have their first point and third red card of the season. They were 2-0 up before Brazilian Jemerson was sent off. After a VAR video screen assessment, looked slightly harsh. Ended up drawing 2-2 against Nîmes. Rennes kept up their perfect start to the season, winning 2-0 at Strasbourg to go top. Lyon and Nice could join them on maximum points. They have games on Tuesday and Wednesday. To Italy now, Nicky Bandini has news from the first weekend of Serie A, including a 4-3 win for Napoli at Fiorentina.
between an underwhelming one-goal win for Juventus, arguments about VAR, and Wanda Icardi making headlines with her late-night TV appearances, Serie A picked up right where it left off in so many ways. But there was some really fun football played as well. Napoli won 4-3 away to Fiorentina in an absolutely bonkers game, which included some brilliant goals for Dries Mertens, Kevin Prince-Boateng, and Lorenzo Insigne, but which also featured an outrageous dive by Mertens to win a penalty, somehow not picked up by the replay officials. And that error was only compounded by Fiorentina then not getting a penalty when Frank Ribéry was hauled down on his way into the box in second half injury time. So they were understandably furious afterwards, but I think Fiorentina could be really fun this season. They have a new American owner, Rocco Commisso, whose takeover caused season ticket sales to jump by about 20% even before he signed Ribéry. And he was out doing a lap of honour before kickoff, which is just the sort of hubris that definitely cannot end badly for anyone. They had seven players 22 or younger in their starting 11 last night, and you just think that combined with the experience of Boateng and Ribéry, it could be a really entertaining mix. But that wasn't the only high-scoring game this weekend. Roma drew 3-3 with Genoa in their first game under Paolo Fonseca, while Atalanta came back from 2-0 down away to Spal to win 3-2. Fewer thrills for Milan, who failed to register a single shot on target in their first game under Marco Giampaolo. But the best story of the weekend came in Verona, where Sinisa Mihajlovic appeared in the dugout for Bologna after spending the past 40 days in hospital being treated for leukemia. He isn't finished with treatment yet. He returned to hospital last night, and we don't know if he'll be back for the next game against Spal or if he'll still be going through that treatment. You could certainly see that the treatment has taken a toll on his body, but he made a promise to his players that he would be there for the first game, and you have to hope this means at least he's on the right path.
Thank you, Nicky. Tuesday and Wednesday, got Carabao Cup second round games. We picked out a couple. Leeds, Stoke, Burnley, Sunderland, Watford, Coventry, Lincoln, Everton, Swansea, Cambridge, of course, and Newcastle, Leicester, the only all Premier League tie. Question from Lexang. Did anyone see the photo of VAR officials getting a takeaway delivery? It was in Greece, and they cut to a video of like the porter cabin, and just in the corner somewhat you just see a hand come in with like a Deliveroo bag and drop it down
of cash.
Give
that penalty.
It could have been cash, it could have been burgers, we have no idea. Does anyone see Lee Catamol making his debut?
Yes.
For VVV Venlo, a tweet just says 84 Catamol kriegt in gele kart. 17 minutes into his debut, got booked.
But they won 2-1, didn't they?
They did win 2-1. And finally, this is from North Stand View. I think it's really a question for Jonathan. Is Tamsin Althwaite old enough to be in New Tricks, realistically? Is New Tricks...
she is, because she plays the role of foil for these old fogies. So she has, by dint of the formulaic nature of the show... she has to be considerably younger than them.
Right, okay.
She can be exasperated by their...
not understanding the internet or something. Yeah. Okay.
I'm impressed by how much you know about pretty bog-standard detective stuff. Because I've never watched New Tricks. It's sort of below my radar.
Well, I saw last night that you were watching Death in Paradise... I thought you were better than that.
Oh, come on,
to be honest.
That is glorious.
The first two series of Death in Paradise are genuinely pretty good. And I think any detective show that constricts itself to an hour is creating difficulties for itself. And I think Death in Paradise does it very well. But the ones with, Ben Miller, I thought they were good. I mean, he is playing a character pretty like me, I accept. Somebody who can't deal with heat and is sort of perpetually cranky and kind of... struggles in social situations.
Are you aware that Max has begun writing a crime thriller with a lead character based on you?
I was not aware of that.
And he hasn't got that far into it, but so far
terrible.
There's a corpse on a slab in a mortuary with its fingertips removed.
And teeth, yeah.
And teeth.
But I don't know
why. And there's also a cow standing nearby.
The cow is a typo, and when I revisited it, I didn't understand why the cow was there. But the detective is called Wilson. You should be honoured.
I am. Yeah.
I wrote it.
Is he ferociously intelligent and good looking?
He plays by the rules.
He's not a maverick.
That's the whole difference. It's the first one who plays by the rules. And I can tell in the first page and a half why every other one writes one who doesn't play by the rules, because it's significantly more interesting. I'll keep plugging away.
Wilson's like the anti Rebus, you know. He plays by the rules. He has no interest whatsoever in music. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink anywhere near as much as Rebus.
I mean, very few people do. I do drink.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I did it because I heard that Richard Osman got a seven-figure advance for writing his crime novel.
His book sounds good, though. I like that setup of an old people's community kind of solving cold cases.
Yeah, well, it turns out he's talented, which is the big difference between him and me as a writer or a human. Yeah, really, every idea turns to gold. How annoying. Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you so much, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Tim.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Detective Wilson.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.